welcome back to another episode of Professionals Podcasting. In this episode, Attorney Bernie addresses the question, do plants have standing in court?
I'm going to defer to my two guests today on that issue. Again, I've got Matthew Kayser here and Gary Howard. They are both Harvard and Oxford educated scientists, and not to forget Carnegie Mellon there. And we meet from time to time to discuss these issues and trying to get a scientific answer sometimes to family law questions that I have. You know, in family law, we try to come up with solutions where families have gone off the rails because of dysfunction. So the question to me was, can dysfunction really be scientifically predicted? Can we look at animal life and plant life and organisms to be able to predict behavior? And if so, we have our off-the-wall question today. Should a plant have standing to apply to court if some of its normal functions and predictable functions have been violated in some way? So I'm going to hand over now to either Matthew or Gary.
Well, thank you, Bernie. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure we have a great answer, but we're happy to talk to you about it. Matt and I have talked a little bit about it in advance, just to sort of get our thoughts together. And, you know, we came down to the idea that the question really has several parts to it. It could be separated into a legal, a biological, and a philosophical aspect. So your question, does a plant have standing in court, of course, causes us to think first legally, and neither Matt and I are attorneys, as you are. So the word standing, we looked it up, not knowing anything about it. Mm-hmm. And there are three elements to it, as I understand it. You can feel free to correct us as appropriate. You know, and the three elements are, first, was there an injury? The second one was, did someone cause the injury? And the third is, can the injury be redressed? And so clearly a tree, for example, could have a branch broken off of it, and that would constitute an injury. And someone might cause that injury, and it could be redressed monetarily because one might want to hire an arborist to treat the plant to prevent an insect or a microbial infestation that would harm the tree further, or the tree might need some further fertilization or water or feedings to facilitate its recovery from the injury. So in that sense, it certainly seems like a plant has standing. I didn't see anywhere in the legal definition of standing that it needed to have agency where the plant itself had to seek redress for the injury. And I could imagine that, for example, a stroke victim or someone like that, or a person in an auto accident with traumatic brain injury may also lack the ability to actually come into court of their own volition, but someone might stand in for them like a relative or an attorney. So in that sense, the plant still seems to be okay, but I think this just sort of begs the question, if you will. Because it's, I don't know where to say beyond that. And the question really is more of a biological one, perhaps. And maybe you want to play with that a little bit, Matthew?
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, do plants have thoughts? Do they have any volition of their own? I think that's a big question. And in some ways, it's now found that plants can communicate with one another. I mean, they do this through pheromones, of course. I mean, that's been well known. But it's also now known that, for example, you know, large forests, and this probably also applies to the grass or large plains and things like that, or any sort of collection of plants, quite often, and probably in most cases, there are a huge fungal communities just below the surface of the soil. And those fungal communicators essentially extend their hyphae, which are essentially just sort of communication organs, between each other to communicate with one another, much in the same way as we have an endocrine system, where we have hormones generated from the pituitary, which then go straight to our thyroid gland, for example, and cause us to produce thyroid hormone. So it's a response to an environmental stimulus into our brain. And they have, so the fungi have these hyphae that they communicate together, but also the trees use these hyphae as well to pass communication signals along as well. So this is also an interesting aspect of a plant communication. Also one other thing that we know that plants do is that if, for example, an insect starts to invade and chop up, for example, leafcutter ants in the tropics, start to damaging the tree itself, the leaves, the branches, etc., that tree will then send out signals to the neighboring trees. It doesn't have to be the same species. Usually they often are the same species, but then send out signals to say, warning, warning, Jim Robinson, there's an insect infestation about to come your way. And those trees start producing alkaloids, which are toxic to insects or taste unpalatable to insects. And so those trees then essentially start to immunize themselves from an attack. So in some ways, there is an element of communication between the systems. And, in general biology, when we understand at the mammalian level, if there's communication between different tissues, that's a sign of showing a not quite self-awareness, but we do have that sort of aspect within our brain as well, essentially communicating with ourselves.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Bernie.
Yeah, I was just saying, so the question really is, to me, is when we look at the biological world, then are these reactions then predictable? Like, therefore, could I look at humans and be able to say that in a given set of circumstances, these actions are predictable?
Well, I think that that's the second sort of phase of this, in a sense, is that how much more advanced are humans than plants or other species? And as Matt just said, there's a lot of communication going on between plant cells, and it's all chemical. But we know that not only in some of the things that Matt said, but in our own brain, we know the way we know parts of the way the brain functions, and parts of those are deeply involved in chemicals. I mean, we know already that certain drugs, legal or illegal, affect the way way our brain works. LSD is a great example. It's illegal and changes the function, changes the way the brain works while it's there. We know that there are neurotransmitters that also facilitate the movement of signals from one neuron to the next in a normal brain, and that the interplay of those are what helps us to be able to think and remember and so forth. So, you can almost wonder, are we only a creature that is reacting to the chemicals in the same way that plants are? And so in that sense, are we in fact that much more cognizant than the plants are, or do we just think we are? And so we also know that there, at least from what we know scientifically, when the physical brain is damaged or dies, the ability of the person to think or remember is also affected or ended, so far as we know. We don't have any, although many people of faith would believe that there's a soul in an afterlife, we don't have any real direct proof of that in the scientific sense. All a matter of faith. So it seems like there's a very strong connection between the physical body and our consciousness. And I think that's one of the great problems left in biology, is to explain that difference between what is just the physical aspects, where we're just an organic computer, if you will, as opposed to a thinking being. In other words, are we less than what we think we are? And I think another big part of that comes from the fact that we don't actually understand how the brain works. I mean, we understand this, the neuron to neuron, the brain cell transmission of information. We understand how the electrical impulse passes down the very long axons that extend from one neuron to the next. We got that down. Both the physics and the chemistry and the biology are all pretty well understood. But the way those connections are made between one neuron to the next, and they could be from a few to 100,000 connections, that code, if you will, is just not understood at all at this point. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, we don't know how memories are built. We don't know, other than the fact that they are involved in those connections.
You mentioned a word, coding, which is interesting to me. You know, to what extent can that coding perhaps be manipulated?
You want that word?
You did, because you... What did you mean by that?
I mean, the coding, yeah, it's a strange word to use in a sense. Sorry about that. You know, DNA, we have a coding. We have Morse code. We have the DNA code. The DNA code is the four bases or letters A, T, G, and C, arranged in a particular order to encode proteins, how those proteins are built, for example. But in this sense, the coding is not the chemical ordering of those. But there's somehow, how are the connections made? In other words, does my memory of what vanilla smells like, how is that encoded in the brain in these connections from neuron to neuron? In other words, does it take 100 connections to 50 different neurons to make that connection so that later on I smell vanilla and I know that's what it is? We don't understand how those are built in the structure of the brain as we understand the brain at this point.
All right. So, I thought you
got. I was going to say, is that more clear, or did I?
No, that is certainly more clear. So my question really to both of you, and maybe Matt, you could start with this. To your knowledge, where are we expecting new groundbreaking research to take place as to the functioning of the brain, and how can we relate that to our everyday experiences?
Well, I think there's been a lot of study of the brain on a cell-by-cell basis, actually, nowadays. So it is understood that in certain regions of the brain, there are ways that you can observe a pattern of how cells interact with each other. And those patterns apparently seem to affect both the experience that's just been had by the individual, and it also can be remembered, in other words, learned, and then can be recapitulated a couple of days later. But there's also similar things where those nerves are arranged in sections of by space, by position, which apparently seems to mimic the position that the animal has been going through over the last, few periods or whatever. So those have been sort of fairly well known. So there are some things like that that are understood. The other thing about sort of down at the cellular level of a single neuron, it is understood how long-term potentiation is involved in memory formation. Long-term potentiation is a way that the cell reorganizes itself to actually essentially stabilize its form, its morphology. And that appears to be the route at how memories are starting to form. And so it's understood that there's also microfilaments within the cell, within that part of the neuron, which form themselves in a particular structure. It's almost like a little scaffold that essentially, with long-term memory formation, that little scaffolding essentially is locked into place. And so that in some ways seems to lock the memory in place. And so when you have encounter a similar environmental situation, that all the signals in your brain are sort of, all the portions of your brain are suddenly flooded with this experience. And those particular parts of that region of the brain, those little cells, essentially light up and say, yes, this is familiar. And so that's how we sort of be able to recognize.
Well, thank you both for coming on today, and really appreciate your contribution to helping people understand the connections between what happens in your real life and science. I guess that's the philosophical part of it. So I don't think we know yet whether we can absolutely scientifically predict behavior in people going forward. I would like to believe that would be possible. I think that would make the world go round. We would have a far more peaceful way of living. Secondly, our question about does a plant have standing? I would say yes, and I would say definitely any kind of organism may have standing. Unfortunately, I think our legal system is set up to make that almost impossible because of property rights. I don't think a court is going to recognize that plant itself has, even by way of a guardian ad litem, can come to court to complain because that plant is actually belongs in the law to a different person. And that may be an area that I think the law should look at down the line. Good luck getting that through the legislature. So thank you, Haley. Thank you for giving us the opportunity of coming on and sharing our thoughts and what we discuss over coffee. This has been a pleasure to have you and Matt and Gary on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.